1956 does not bring any achievement for Israel. The fire smolders under the ashes in 1967. Israel suddenly attacks Egypt. The Egyptian army is caught off guard. What the Egyptian forces are doing, though, accompanied by great courage, does not lead to anything. Egyptian soldiers are besieged in the Sinai Desert. Israel seeks revenge. They massacre the Egyptian soldiers. After Egypt, the remaining Arab countries also suffer defeat. As a result, Israel occupies more land. The main factor in the Arabs' defeat was the support of the United States, advanced telecommunications equipment, and espionage activities. More importantly, it was the fate of Palestine, which was on the line. After the war, the area of Israel triples. Many become refugees, and the remaining people are trapped under Israeli rule. Grief and sorrow have engulfed the Arabs. In 1967, the United Nations adopted a resolution in the hope that Israel would withdraw from the occupied lands. However, Israel conditions its withdrawal from the occupied territories on the recognition of its legitimacy. This is vital to them. In response, Arabs emphasize three things: no peace, no negotiations, and no recognition of Israel. 3 years after the Six-Day War, Israel does not relinquish any of the occupied lands. They make excuses. For example, they do not return the Sinai Desert to Egypt under the pretext of Israeli security. Therefore, in 1973, Egypt and Syria launch attacks to forcibly reclaim their lands in the Sinai and the Golan Heights. The war initially sees some victories, but with direct intervention from the United States, the war's fate changes. The war ends with the defeat of the Arabs. In 1977, Anwar Sadat, president of Egypt, travels to Israel in a state of disbelief. Conversations begin. 1 year later, negotiations lead to results. Egypt surrenders. The Camp David Accords are signed. In Camp David, it is agreed that in exchange for peace, Israel will withdraw from Gaza and the West Bank of the Jordan River, paving the way for self-governance or Palestinian authority in these regions. In essence, Camp David was a document to officially recognize Israel so that it would not be isolated. Egypt was the biggest threat to Israel from the start, and Israel tried in every way to find peace from Egypt's side.
So we should be such neighbors that they would feel that it's nice to live with us.
So it was necessary for Egypt, as the first Arab country, to recognize Israel in order to eliminate the biggest threat to Israel forever. In the 1970s, everything was in favor of Israel. Continuous victories, success after success. There was no news about the Israeli society. What was seen were the victories of the army. Meanwhile, within the society, strange events were taking place that conflicted with human values. After the war, thousands of Jews migrated to the occupied lands, including Yemenis. They were settled in temporary camps. Different individuals, men and women, old and young, appeared in those camps. Women arrived with their children and infants. Immediately, medical examinations began. Doctors, under the pretext of more detailed examinations, took some children with them. It was said they would return the next day, but the next day, there was no news of the children. Those children never returned. Families followed through the matter, but a strange event occurs. It is said that your children are missing. They are gone. Some time later, another news is announced to them: your children are dead. The cause of death is never revealed. Yemeni children were lively and cheerful before being sent to the hospital, but on the way to the hospital, they bid farewell to their childhood forever. The peak of the missing children statistics is reached in 1953. It is said that nearly 5,000 people have disappeared. Shortly after, a fact-finding committee is formed. The investigations yield no specific results. The fate of the children remains unknown. Even worse than that is the function of the committees, as in each review of documents, a series of records go missing and no trace is left behind. The documents, like the children themselves, vanish into thin air. As time goes by, secrets are revealed about what had happened to the kids. The children were subjected to a host of nondescript medical tests. The clinical tests were made in the city of Haifa. Physicians had tried different methods of treatment on the children's bodies, including direct injection of dry protein. The kids were used as laboratory mice. In one case, four Yemeni children suffering from malnutrition were injected with dry protein. This causes the death of children. Dr. George Mendel, head of the children's hospital, was aware of the tests. There were even worse cases among the files of Yemeni children: unethical and inhumane things, organ theft. The body parts of Yemeni children had been stolen and a bitter fate had been set for them. However, it is not known exactly how many children were killed in such a manner. The story of Yemeni children grieves many families, but the crime against children was not just for Yemeni immigrants. Immigrant families, even from the Balkan region, were involved with this issue. The depth of the disaster was much greater than what was revealed in the media. In essence, in the Israeli society, those who had a weaker position were harassed more than others. Traces of discrimination and racism were clearly seen in the case of Yemeni children. The authorities tried to make the situation seem normal, but the events that happened indicated many gaps and ruptures in Israeli society, which they tried to ignore and keep hidden forever.
And the Arabs are inferior?
I wouldn't like to say that, but I think as fighting goes, they are.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
In the absence of political change to tackle America's epidemic of gun violence, survivors of mass shooting incidents have been launching multi-million dollar lawsuits against gun makers, gun dealers, technology companies, and the U.S. federal government for their failure to protect them. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. Supreme Court said on Friday, 4th of October, it will decide whether to block a $10 billion lawsuit that Mexico filed against U.S. gun manufacturers and distributors that argues that their negligent and illegal commercial practices have unleashed bloodshed in Mexico. The lawsuit filed in Boston, Massachusetts in August named Smith & Wesson, Barrett Firearms, Beretta, Colt and Glock, as well as Boston area wholesaler Interstate Arms. The Mexican government says it wants to put an end to the massive damage that the defendants caused by actively facilitating the unlawful trafficking of their guns to drug dealers and other criminals in Mexico. According to the Foreign Affairs Ministry, Mexico says 70% of the weapons trafficked to Mexico come from the United States. It has said in 2019 alone, at least 17,000 homicides were linked to trafficked weapons. Alejandro Solorio, legal advisor for the Mexican government, has said the damage caused by the trafficked guns would be equal to 1.7% to 2% of Mexico's gross domestic product, or GDP. But the firearms industry, through its U.S. lobbying body, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, has said the charges in the lawsuit are baseless. When the lawsuit was filed in 2021, Lawrence Keene, the group's senior vice president and general counsel, claimed the Mexican government is responsible for the rampant crime and corruption within their own borders. That case has been through a number of lower court rulings. It was initially tossed out by a district court, then revived by the first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The gunmakers appealed that ruling to the Supreme Court, arguing they have followed lawful practices and the case has no business in U.S. courts of law. In August, U.S. District Judge Dennis Saylor dismissed the case against six of the eight companies, ruling that Mexico had not provided enough evidence that violence in the country was caused by U.S. gun manufacturers' negligence. Now the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear the gunmakers' petition. Lawyers for Mexico defended the appeal court's ruling's rationale and argued that it was premature for the Supreme Court to take up the case. Mexico claims U.S. gunmakers know that the chain from the manufacturer to distributor to dealer ends with sales to straw buyers, who in turn sell them to the cartels, especially military-style weapons with serial numbers that are easy to erase. Attorneys for Smith & Wesson contend Mexico is trying to use the American court system to bankrupt the American firearms industry based on a novel and far-fetched legal claim. They argue that they are no more responsible for what dealers do than Budweiser is for a liquor store selling beer to a child. Mexico is not the only country to claim that United States guns are a destabilizing influence. A United Nations report in January of this year estimated that 500,000 legal and illegal weapons had flooded into Haiti since 2020. The U.S. State Department has indicated it plans a new policing unit in Haiti to address weapons being trafficked into the country, which continues to be destabilized by gang violence. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story from a different angle. The United States is known as one of the most litigious countries in the world, and in recent years there's been a new effort to apply that reputation to one of the nation's most vexing problems, the problem of gun violence. In the absence of political change to tackle the United States' epidemic of gun violence, survivors of mass shooting incidents have been launching multi-million dollar lawsuits against gun makers, gun dealers, technology companies, and the U.S. federal government for their failure to protect them. While lawsuits against the gun industry have happened before, their increased use now is in part due to the rise of large, well-resourced violence prevention groups backing them as a tool for change, to shift the narrative about who bears responsibility for mass shootings, and to force the gun industry, social media companies, and the federal government to shift their practices. Dion Green, who survived a mass shooting incident in Dayton, Ohio in 2019, said, "The lawsuits are created because we can't get anything done at the state level, local or federal level, so we go for the manufacturers." Dion Green added, "No one likes when their money gets attacked." When a gunman opened fire in Dayton, Ohio's Arts and Entertainment District just over 5 years ago, 9 people, including Dion Green's father, Derek Fudge, were killed and dozens more were injured. Green's father died in his arms that night. Green went on to establish the Fudge Foundation, through which he speaks to youth about the harms caused by gun violence, supports crime victims, and travels to communities that have been similarly rocked by mass shooting incidents. Since his father's death, Dion Green has helped reform the way victim compensation is doled out and has railed against lax gun policies like permitless carry. He said he never wanted to be involved in a lawsuit, but he began to see it as a way to get high-capacity drum magazines off the streets of the United States, like the 100-round drum the shooter used to kill his father. So he called around to find someone who would represent him and other families in a lawsuit. Dion Green said, "It's a very tiresome and angry process to deal with attorneys who won't try the case. They push you off because of the entity you're going up against." Nearly 2 years and at least 8 rejections later, Dion Green and 5 other victims' families connected with Ben Cooper, an attorney based in Columbus, Ohio. Ben Cooper specializes in wrongful death cases. Cooper recalled, "They were trying to figure out so many things. What can we do? Who can we hold accountable? How can we get compensation for the harm that's been caused? And how can we make a broader impact from this horrible tragedy?" In 2021, Ben Cooper filed a lawsuit against Kyung Chang Industry USA, Inc., the parent company of the Nevada-based gun magazine maker and retailer the shooter used. The lawsuit charges the company knew that large-capacity magazines were attractive to people who were planning mass shootings and sold them online anyway, without any reasonable safeguards, screening, or limits. While many view the $73 million settlement for families and survivors of the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting as the beginning of a mass shooting litigation, these types of lawsuits have been around since at least the 1980s. For the past 30 years, attorney Jonathan Lowy has represented people affected by shootings, including the 2002 sniper shootings in Washington, D.C., and dozens of families and law enforcement officers who were shot in lesser-known incidents. In the 1990s, when 30 major U.S. cities filed a groundbreaking lawsuit that led to Smith & Wesson agreeing to change the way it makes and sells guns, Lowy represented most of the plaintiff's cities. Lowy, founder of Global Action on Gun Violence, a non-profit organization that helps countries take legal action against gun manufacturers, said, What they really want out of a lawsuit is change. Every single one of them wants to do something to make it less likely that other families suffer the way that they have suffered.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The people of Africa have come out strongly to support the resistance of the people of Palestine and Lebanon against the Israeli apartheid regime. Are African governments listening to the masses? Art is now a strong medium being used by many across Africa to express solidarity with the oppressed nations of Lebanon and Palestine. So how effective is it in exposing the evils of the Israeli regime? To discuss Africa's support for the resistance in Palestine and Lebanon, we have contacted Suraya Dadu. She is an independent writer and researcher, and she focuses on African solidarity with Palestine. We have also contacted Professor Abdulwahab Sheikh Abdi Samad. He is the Chief Executive Officer of the Afro-Asia Institute for Strategic Studies. The U.S.-Israeli genocide against Palestinians in Gaza has regrettably entered its second year by spreading into Lebanon despite global calls for peace. Over the past year, the people of Africa have expressed their support for the heroic anti-Israeli resistance by the oppressed people of Palestine and Lebanon. From Pretoria to Rabat, Africans are participating in large protests to denounce the Israeli apartheid regime for its genocidal crimes in West Asia. Now, this support is not just in the streets. In spite of the limitations imposed by Western pro-Israeli social media sites, people across the continent have been actively expressing online solidarity for the oppressed nations of Palestine and Lebanon. Amid the suppression of pro-resistance voices in certain Arab countries, Africans have stepped up to highlight U.S.-Israeli atrocities in Gaza and Lebanon on an international level. So what is the key message behind Africa's backing of the anti-Israeli resistance in West Asia?
Africa supports resistance. The liberation of Palestine has been supported by Africans for decades, and this support is seen as a joint struggle against racism and imperialism, as well as a disapproval of Zionism. In a 1975 resolution of the question of Palestine, the Organization of African Unity, that later transformed into the African Union, condemned the Israeli regime's crimes and also supported the Palestinian people in their struggle against Zionist racist colonialism. The OAU resolution also called on UN members to end political, military, cultural, and economic ties with the Zionist regime.
South African Reverend Dr. Alan Boisak, a leading supporter of the Palestinian resistance, speaks here during a rally in Cape Town to express solidarity with Palestine and to condemn Israeli genocide against Palestinians.
The importance of this event is that we are joining millions of people across the world in a global day of solidarity with Palestine. And to be honest with you, if you had asked me 5 years ago whether we would ever have such a day in the numbers that we are having it today across the world and here, I would have thought that was an impossible dream. It was a joke, because unlike us, especially after 1976 and the revolution of the children and the slaughter in Soweto, and then later on across the world, across the country, the world had risen up in solidarity with South Africa. I mean, I saw that with my own eyes during the 1980s, that even the mighty pro-apartheid Reagan regime had to adopt an anti-apartheid bill which sanctioned South Africa quite severely. And so, but Palestine has never had that. And for Palestinians, this must be a wonderful, wonderful moment. And I am so glad that Cape Town has realized what a privilege it is for us to participate in a day like this.
Well, thousands of people marched to Parliament in Cape Town early October, 1 year since the start of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Now, the demonstration was in solidarity with the anti-Israeli resistance movement in Lebanon and Palestine. Professor Abdul Samad, what is the most important message of such rallies in Africa amid the U.S.-backed Israeli genocide against Palestinians?
Ali, the world is witnessing. The world, right, that as we speak right now, is witnessing the genocidal regime in Israel. What they are right now, what they are doing right now, is a systematic, massacre. They're massacring the civilians. It's a genocide, ethnic cleansing, destroying homes, hospitals, schools, bookshops, marketplaces, residential areas. In fact, it's a indiscriminate killing of the children, women, and elderly people. That's exactly the world is watching, exactly what the genocidal regime of Israel are doing. Now, the rallies you have seen in Cape Town and elsewhere in the world, in Latin America and global south, it's a reality. It is a kind of the world now is witnessing such kind of horrific pictures which coming from the Israel, Gaza, and also Lebanon as well. And most of the African society, specifically the South African society, they know the bane of the apartheid regime. They know the bane of the colonizers. They know, they test it and they know it. That's why the large number of South African, society are demonstrating against, is Israel.
A prominent Kenyan activist, Dr. Miguna Miguna, in his message on X, stated that Benjamin Netanyahu is an indicted war criminal and racist butcher of innocent civilians. This is quite a profound statement and a pointer to a major awakening sweeping across among intellectuals and the academia in Africa.
I really agree with Miguna Miguna. Netanyahu is a war criminal, he's a racist. And what he's doing right now is against the international law, is against international humanitarian law. The International Criminal Court of Justice, they issue warrant of arrest against Netanyahu, and also his defense minister, Gallant.
In his message following the martyrdom of Said Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, stated that without the support of the United States, Britain, and other Western powers, the Israeli regime will be a useless entity. Clearly, there's an awakening in Africa on the destructive role of Western powers, not just in the continent, but also in West Asia. Professor, what's your view on this statement by Sheikh Zakzaki?
Sheikh Zakzaki is absolutely correct. The Western world has no value to defend. The Western world, they are blindly supporting genocidal regime in Israel. They are providing military hardware. They are providing economically, politically, and also materially so that they can continue systematic killing of Palestinians and destroying the property and the civilian in Lebanon. And exactly, international humanitarian law, They claim to be the defenders of humanitarian law. They claim to be the defenders of the international humanitarian law. Unfortunately, what is going on today in Gaza and Lebanon are completely, we have seen the true colors of the Western world. We have seen the Western civilizations. We have seen whatever they are telling us in Africa and elsewhere in the world. It's just what you call a political gimmick. Has nothing to do what they're preaching. And what, in fact, what we have seen in Gaza today, absolutely, you know, the Israeli regime, it seems above the international law. It seems above the international humanitarian law.
Western powers backed the apartheid regime in South Africa and criminalized the resistance by indigenous Africans. History is repeating itself in Palestine and Lebanon, where legitimate resistance is branded as terrorism by Western powers. Professor Abdul Samad, our last question. Now, what lessons can we learn from the double standards by Western powers?
Somebody's terrorist, someone else, you know, a hero. And I'll give you an example of the, you know, Nelson Mandela. Mandela was a terrorist in the eyes of the Western imperialism, in the eyes of the colonizers, in the eyes of the apartheid regime. He was a terrorist. But the African societies and the rest of the world, they see Mandela as a hero, as a resistance. Today, Hamas, the global south, and most of the international community, they consider as a resistance army against the, you know, genocidal regime in Israel. And some people also they see Israel as a terrorist state, or massacring and killing indiscriminately in the children, women, and elderly people, and destroying the property and everything. So the issue of the terrorism, in fact, in the Western world and the rest of the world, are two different issues. So and what basically I'm saying here is, and respecting, you know, if you don't respect international law, if you don't respect humanitarian law, if you are not, in fact, you know, respecting the basic human rights, then someone who destroying, you know, someone who's just committed ethnic cleansing, that's exactly a terrorist. Someone who destroying the property of the people, that's exactly a terrorist. Someone who massacring and committing genocide, that's exactly a terrorist. You cannot call a legitimate resistance as a terrorist. You can't call that. And that's exactly the word of terrorism is no longer viable in the eyes of international community. Compare whatever they are saying, you know, the Western world and the British and the Ukrainians, you know, and new settlers, their terrorism is no longer a terrorist in the eyes of the international community.
Well, quite a powerful definition of terrorism there. I would like to thank Professor Abdul Wahab Sheikh Abdul Samad for his very incisive analysis. We now take a short break before we continue our discussion on Africa's support for the resistance movement in Palestine and Lebanon. Stay with us.
The Art of Resistance in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Artists in Africa are showing their support for the anti-Israeli resistance movement in Palestine and Lebanon through the use of art in order to bring more attention to the issue and integrate it into everyday life, both locally and internationally. For instance, in Senegal, artists use graffiti to raise awareness by painting supporting messages for Palestine and Lebanon on the walls of Dakar in response to the genocide carried out by the U.S. and Israel against these two oppressed nations. In September, a group of artists, writers, and academics in South Africa worked together on an exhibition with the theme, Palestine Will Soon Be Free from the River to the Sea. Also in Kenya, an exhibition was held at the Kenya National Theater in Nairobi, where art pieces showing the brutality of the Israeli regime on Palestinians were exhibited. The masses in Africa are showing solidarity with the anti-Israeli resistance in different ways, such as demonstrations, online campaigns, and artistic expression. So, will African governments take notice of the widespread support in the continent for the resistance in Palestine and Lebanon against the Israeli apartheid regime? In Senegal, protesters have held several demonstrations over the last 1 year to condemn the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza. Protesters have urged stronger international action to stop the spread of the Israeli genocide across the region.
I am here today as people all over the world to call for an end to the massacre of Palestinians in Gaza, to tell Israel to stop this massacre, to tell Israel that the children of this massacring have done nothing wrong, to tell Israel to respect international law, to tell Israel to stop massacring schools, and to tell Israel that cutting off the water supplies to Gaza is a crime against humanity.
I am here not as an Arab, not as a Muslim. I am here as a human being because the atrocities that I've seen happening in Gaza that I grew up seeing, that I was less than 2 years old, seeing all these massacres happening in Gaza. This is why I am here today, to support my people, to support, to stop the apartheid, to stop the genocide, and to save the people in Gaza.
Apart from demonstrations, the people of Senegal are now using art as a strong medium of supporting resistance. The Pan-African graffiti artists and the anti-apartheid African artists group in Senegal have collaborated to create graffiti in Dakar to raise awareness about the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Palestine and now Lebanon. Ms. Sureya Dadu, what is the importance of art in supporting the resistance, and how effective is it as a medium of conveying the message of solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine and Lebanon?
So I think it's interesting that you mentioned the word resistance and supporting resistance, because resistance, I think, is a very broad concept. And things like art, culture, graffiti, those are all forms of resistance. But they reach a very different audience. They're a different medium. And it's important ways in raising awareness about the occupation of Palestine, about the Israeli genocide that is currently underway. And they manage to reach different people, perhaps people who would not necessarily know too much about the issue. There are also very creative ways in raising awareness, not simply just through traditional means of media and social media. And particularly in Africa, depending on where it is that the graffiti is located, it has the ability to reach vast numbers of people. Those groups that you had just spoken about were very effective.
Protesters in South Africa carried placards that read, "Don't buy, don't supply, and don't play with apartheid Israel," and "Boycott apartheid Israel." Several African countries continue to trade with the Israeli regime amid the regime's genocidal war against the people of Palestine.
Netanyahu, you can hide.
We charge you with genocide.
We charge you with genocide.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
We're protesting the illegal occupation of the Palestinian land.
We want to thank each and every one of you coming here, especially the children and the elderly. But today I've got a special request from each one of you, and that is, number one, never stop talking about Palestine. And I also want to request from each and everyone in Cape Town and South Africa to do something practical, continuously, because this fight is going to be a long fight. If a ceasefire is going to happen tomorrow and the hostage is going to be given over and changed, it's not the end.
Recently, South Africa's leading opposition politician, Julius Malema, addressed President Cyril Ramaphosa in Parliament regarding the country's diplomatic stance towards the Israeli apartheid regime. Now, this discussion follows a non-binding resolution passed by the South African Parliament in November last year, which called for suspending diplomatic ties with Tel Aviv. Let's take a listen.
What is your reluctance? Because that resolution was taken when you were the president of South Africa, committed to the people of Palestine. Yes. You must take and practical action like Brazil did. Brazil said the ambassador of Brazil must be withdrawn completely. Yes.
Honorable member, your time
Why
is up.
Why are you scared to withdraw our embassy and close Honourable the Israeli
member,
embassy in South Africa?
Your time is up, Mr. President.
The executive has noted, fully noted what the National Assembly took a resolution on. And we have said, as we have been asked, that this matter is being considered, and we're also considering the various broad issues around it. Our support for the cause of the Palestinians is irrevocable, and we have articulated that here from time to time. And the various other aspects of putting pressure on Israel to do what is right by and for the Palestinians are matters that are being considered, and a number of proposals have been put forward.
We've heard and seen there the South African president emphasizing that the country's support for Palestine remains irrevocable. Ms. Surayadad, what's your take on this statement by the South African president?
I think as a South African, it is about time that South Africa starts translating symbolic gestures into tangible, real actions. This isn't the first time that South Africa has spoken about breaking ties with Israel. In November last year, the South African parliament voted overwhelmingly to cut relations with Israel. And unfortunately, the government of Cyril Ramaphosa did not translate that very powerful gesture into an action. So it really is time, if South Africa wants to give real meaning to its act of taking Israel to the ICJ, then I think, again, it needs to follow up and actually break ties. This will serve as a very important example to other African countries and indeed to many countries in the global south. And I think when that happens, we could then see real change.
In August, Namibia refused to allow an explosive-laden ship destined for the occupied Palestinian territories to dock at its ports after suspecting that the vessel's consignments were to be used in the Israeli regime's ongoing genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. This is a pointer that some governments in Africa are now listening to the masses that are demanding total rejection of the Israeli genocidal regime. Dozens of Moroccans demonstrated recently in the capital Rabat in solidarity with Palestine and Lebanon, demanding an end to normalization with Israel. The protesters chanted the slogans in front of the parliament building, praising the Palestinian and the Lebanese resistance, and others demanding an end to the normalization with the Zionist enemy. Among the slogans chanted by the protesters were, "From Gaza to Beirut, the will of resistance will not die."
It was an important action by the Namibian authorities in denying the Catherine permission to dock. And I do believe it's something that was also emulated by Angola. Unfortunately, Germany has now allowed that vessel permission to dock. Unfortunately, though, Namibia, as I mentioned previously, continues to trade with Israel. It has relations with Israel, and other African countries, including South Africa, also do. So the will of the Namibian people, the will of the South African people, I don't think is reflected in the policies and in the conduct of the governments of Namibia and South Africa. Because as long as you treat Israel like a normal state, then you are not moving in tandem with the masses. Most African countries, I feel, should emulate the example of Colombia and its president, who within months cut diplomatic ties, has paused military deals, has halted the exports of coal. And I think it shows that if there is real political will amongst governments, amongst political leaders, then boycott, divestment and sanctions is very possible. And it is those kinds of actions that I think will make Israel comply with international law. It will put pressure on Israeli leaders in the same way that the apartheid South African government was pressurized into dismantling apartheid, essentially by the international community.
The support for the resistance movement in Morocco is stronger than ever before, despite the country's monarchy normalization deal with the Israeli entity. Now, can we say that the situation in Morocco reflects how some rulers of African and Arab countries are detached from the reality on the ground?
I think they are. That is a fairly accurate statement because, as you mentioned, Morocco, it is a country that its people, its population is staunchly pro-Palestinian. They support the Palestinian liberation struggle. Yet the government and its rulers, its political leadership have normalized relations with Israel. They treat Israel as they would any other country instead of shunning them as they should, because it should be treated, Israel should be treated as an apartheid state in the same way in which apartheid South Africa was. So to a large extent, yes, it's not just Morocco. I feel there are several other countries in Africa in which the wishes of the people and the population have not been respected, and governments don't necessarily reflect the will of the people. Throughout Africa, Africa is a continent that traditionally has been in solidarity with Palestine, because Africans see in Palestine their own history of anti-colonial struggle, their own history of apartheid, their own history of oppression. And so naturally, Africans and the African people are in solidarity. It's just that the countries and the governments, their political leaders are not. And I think to some extent, part of the reason why the political leadership isn't showing the same support as its people is that the Israeli government has, particularly since 2016, used different means to buy support for Israel on the African continent.
Well, unfortunately, our time is over for today. I'd like to thank our guest, Surya Dado, an expert of African solidarity with Palestine, for her insight today. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. From Mubarak, Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
The fast approaching end of a racist terrorist entity supported in its crimes against humanity by the most lethal U.S. weapons and hundreds of billions of dollars of the American taxpayers' money for razing towns to rubble and brutally slaughtering the innocent is a reality that cannot be denied. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Kahan International wrote, "The illegal Zionist entity is at its wits' end in view of its crimes in desperation in Lebanon, where it has so far indiscriminately massacred over 2,000 men, women and children, while continuing its genocide in Gaza and committing growing acts of terrorism in the West Bank of River Jordan, in addition to attacks on Syria and Yemen." Usurper Israel, which earlier this week was the target of a barrage of at least 180 Iranian missiles that wrought extensive damage to three of its major military air bases, carefully avoiding any casualties, since Islam does not permit the killing of civilians, will not last long. This fast-approaching end of a racist terrorist entity, supported in its crimes against humanity by the most lethal U.S. weapons and hundreds of billions of dollars of the American taxpayers' money for razing towns to rubble and brutally slaughtering the innocent, is a reality that cannot be denied. These and other facts regarding the strength of the axis of resistance were pointed out by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in his historic Friday prayer sermon in Tehran, where he presided over the regular weekly gathering of the faithful after almost 5 years. Millions of the pious and patriotic Tehranis had assembled to pray behind their beloved leader and listen to his sermons at the sprawling Imam Khomeini Mosalla in defiance of the threats of war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu to attack Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei warned the dastards in Tel Aviv and the dotards in Washington of the Islamic Republic's far more powerful response with hitherto unused advanced missiles in case the Zionists and their backers were to commit the blunder of attacking Iran. He said Iran's vengeance for the cowardly assassination last July in Tehran of Iranian guest Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh was lawful and in accordance with international law. The leader of the Islamic Revolution also hailed as legitimate last year's Operation Al-Aqsa Storm by the Gazans, who have every right to confront the Zionist regime's unabated terrorism of the past 76 years, and was fully confident of the success of Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist movement, the Hezbollah, in defeating the Zionist entity despite the martyrdom of its leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. "The axis of resistance is now more than determined to bring Israel and its criminal backers to their knees, since the cherished goal of all the conscientious people is the liberation of Palestine by carrying the struggle to the enemy's camp." This became evident recently by the heroic incursion into the northern parts of occupied Palestine by the famed Red One Brigade of Hezbollah, which, according to the last reports, has taken control of Qirat Shemona and so far captured a number of Israeli troops, in addition to killing and injuring a large number of them. Meanwhile, Crescent International Road, after weeks of threatening to attack Hezbollah with ground forces, the Zionist first attempt ended in disaster. At dawn, October 2nd, when the Zionist regime's elite commando force tried to sneak into South Lebanon, Hezbollah Radwan force was ready for them. They ambushed the infiltrating Zionist force at Odeise, causing massive casualties. The Zionist regime's so-called elite commandos fled screaming and crying in fear. The Zionist regime military has admitted that 7 of its troops were killed, bringing the total death to 8 in a few hours of combat. At least 20 others were injured. Later in the day, the Zionist regime military said in a statement that 3 of those killed were commanders and 7 other troops were critically wounded. Hezbollah, meanwhile, announced destroying 3 Israeli Merkava tanks with guided missiles. In a separate report, Sky News Arabia quoted an Israeli source as saying that 14 Israeli soldiers were killed in battle on October 2nd. Hebrew media reports said there were 20 ambulances at the border with Lebanon to evacuate the wounded. 4 helicopters were also on standby to lift them to hospitals. Israeli media reported a very unusual and extremely difficult event in the north. The Rambam Hospital in Haifa and the Ziv Hospital in Safat declared a mass casualty event in the north, while Israeli media noted that Hezbollah was shelling the border area massively using heavy firepower. Seething with anger at the cowardly assassination of Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and anxious to confront the Zionist aggressors, Hezbollah resistance fighters laid out a careful trap for them. The Zionists are experts at killing civilians, especially children and women, and attacking civilian infrastructure. When faced by Hezbollah's Radwan force, they fled the battlefield. The Islamic Resistance Movement said in a statement that the operation was in support of our steadfast Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip and in solidarity with its brave and honorable resistance, as well as in defense of Lebanon and its people. Hezbollah successfully confronted the invading Zionist force attempting to sneak into Lebanon through the village of Odeise from the Khalet al-Mahafer area. Hezbollah direct combat with the Zionist occupation forces came a day after Iran had launched more than 200 hypersonic missiles at Israeli regime military targets. They achieved direct hits at multiple air bases, including the ones at Tel Nof near Tel Aviv, Ramon, Hatzerim and Nevatim in the south, the latter home to Israel's U.S.-supplied F-35 fighter planes, and completely destroyed, as were 20 planes. 3 air bases have been put out of commission completely. Iran's military and Revolution Guards released video footage of the strikes, refuting Israeli and Western media claims that no damage was caused. If so, why impose a total ban on reporting of what was destroyed in Iran's missile strikes? The Iraqi Islamic Resistance Forces, meanwhile, announced that should Israel or America target Islamic Iran, not a drop of oil will flow through the Persian Gulf. Zionists and imperialist warmongers, beware! North America and Europe are risking a cold winter.